It's difficult, I think, to overstate how seriously rabbinic tradition took the interpretation of the laws and following through the rules that they developed to prevent themselves from getting anywhere close to violating God's law. And at the beginning of chapter 6 in Luke, we find the first of a number of little snits about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. Now, put as simply as possible, you will remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, and you will not work. Those are the main points of the commandment. The rabbis, out of the desire to figure out how to fulfill that commandment, engaged in volume-long discussions of what holiness meant on the Sabbath as distinct to any other time, and what it meant to not work. And it has been debated. Now, that's not a surprise, because that's what the rabbis did the best, is debate and debate and debate and debate and debate. And that's the way they taught, and that's the way they learned, was through discussion of every possible angle of every possible thing. And if you go by a conservative or an Orthodox synagogue, especially in Israel, on a Friday evening, they will have their readings, they will have the blessings and the prayers, and then they will sit and debate what it all means. And you can hear it on the street. And if you think Baptists make a lot of noise when they're saying hi or when they're saying bye or whatever comes in between, you just need to know that you need ear protection to go to some of these synagogues. In 1992, just to give you an example of how intense the concern was to not violate the rules that human beings developed in order to not violate the law. Just to give you an example of this, just in 1992, this was the year I came back from Israel, there was a fire in an apartment in a conservative Orthodox section of Jerusalem. And the fire started on the Sabbath, on Saturday, during the day. But the Orthodox interpretation of work included opening and closing electronic circuits, turning light switches on and off. So if you wanted a light in the dining room on the Sabbath, you left it on before sundown on Friday. Okay? I've seen Orthodox folks come running out of the house to get a Gentile to come and turn a light on because they didn't want to violate that rule. It meant that in some apartment buildings on Saturday, the elevators are programmed to run continuously and stop at every floor, so you don't have to push the buttons. It's a slow way to get up and downstairs, but this fire started in an apartment. And the question was, is it lawful on the Sabbath to use the telephone in this situation? And they went and found the rabbi who, thank goodness, didn't live too far away, and for half an hour discussed whether or not it was lawful to use the telephone. I'm not making this up. Whether or not it was lawful to use the telephone on the Sabbath, and eventually they decided in this case it was lawful to use the telephone, but by that time, two other apartments had completely been gutted before they could get beyond the interpretation of their tradition to determine that, you know what, and we know this from the teaching of Jesus, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do what causes harm? And there is a principle behind the law that should be evident. And that's the principle behind all of God's law, is that it is given to us for good. Sometimes as we apply it, we cause more problems in other ways. But we find the disciples, and of course, the Pharisees are spoiling for an argument. They're looking to start a debate. This is the thing they do. Jesus doesn't do a lot of debate, not the way the Pharisees do. He usually gets it. They'll get him at the beginning of what would be a debate for them, and he'll ask them a question or make a statement, and boom, it's done. He doesn't give them anything to sort of latch onto, to nitpick, which is what they want to do. And Jesus and his disciples, now they're going through the field. It's the Sabbath. It's Saturday. One wonders how far they're walking or where. And obviously, somebody forgot to put the casserole in on Friday because they've got nothing to eat on Saturday. It's a bunch of guys. Wow. What do you expect? So they're going through the field, We know it's got to be March, February, March. The grains, maybe a little bit earlier. The grains are ripe enough that you can pick them from the... They're just snacking, okay? But the strict observance of the rabbinical rules was that if you're plucking these kernels and you're rolling them between your hands and getting rid of the chaff and popping them in your mouth and just gnawing on wheat or barley or whatever, you are harvesting, threshing, winnowing, and preparing food. And the very, very strict rabbinic interpretation of what they were doing would include those things. It's not stealing, because there are allowances in the Old Testament for gleaning around, you know, the leftovers and the bits. When you harvest a field, there's always stuff that you miss. So they're not stealing, but the rabbis, stealing would have been a violation of the law. But there are provisions for that, the snack, if you will. The rabbis are wanting to get them on what it turns out to be their interpretation of not working on the Sabbath. And Jesus comes back to them with a couple of stunners. One is the biblical precedent. Have you not read, and surely they would not admit to not having read something in the Bible, have you not read how David went into the temple itself, not just across the field, went into the sanctuary, took the showbread that is part of the offering, and ate it himself in a time of need, and fed it to those who were with him so they would not go hungry. And it was lawful for him to do so. And, well, surely they don't want to admit to him that they haven't read it. Can you imagine that? But also, admitting that they have read it, they're hearing him make a statement. He's making an identification between himself and who? David. He's already established to the Pharisees that he has the authority to forgive sin. And demonstrated it in such a way that they had to acknowledge that if he can do what he just did in the healing of this paralytic, certainly he has who else can do that? Now he is claiming a parallel between himself and King David, which certainly exists. Not just claiming, he's pointing it out. It's part of his lineage, and these people were as nitpicky about their lineage and what tribe and what clan and everything they were from as they were about observing the law. They knew his family. And David is in his ancestry in a direct line. So he's identifying himself with David, and then he makes the statement, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Who's he telling them he is? He's saying, if we're going to bicker here about what is lawful on the Sabbath, guess what? I'll tell you, and not the other way around. I will tell you, and not the other way around. We move on into the next bit here in chapter 6, and we find that there's another Sabbath. He's gone to a synagogue. He was teaching. And there was a man who happened to be there. We don't know if he was placed or not, but there was a man there whose hand was shriveled. And we don't know any more detail about that, but certainly wasn't able to use his hand. And the Pharisees were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, and they were watching him to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. All right, not to see if he would heal. They were waiting to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Now, I can't come up with a verse anywhere in all of Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy that says, thou shalt not heal on the Sabbath. All right, but their understanding of work is pretty comprehensive. So they're not wondering whether or not he's going to heal somebody. They are expecting that he's going to do this. They can see this coming. Here's Jesus, he's teaching. He's been working miracles now among them for weeks, if not months. And here is this man with the shriveled hand. They're like, They expect him to heal the guy, don't they? Do we? No. Think about it. When it's your hand that's shriveled, do you just assume God is going to deal with this? I mean, that's what we should be doing. And if we've learned, we might fret about when he's going to do something about it and what exactly is he going to do about it, and we can make an awful lot of noise and nattering, all right, a lot of spiritual chatter. you know, in your prayer time and talking with each other. But the Pharisees took it for granted that Jesus was going to heal this guy. And you can think of instances where, if not in your own life, in other people's lives, it was really kind of hard to know. Is God going to work there or not? And when? Well, yes. He heals them. He hits them with the rabbinic question, is it lawful to do good or bad? Literally just good or bad. Are you going to bless or are you going to do harm? Are you going to do something that is good for someone, or by your doing nothing at all, are you going to cause them injury or further pain on the Sabbath? In which is more lawful according to the Spirit of God and the Spirit of the law, which was given to bless mankind? The observance of God's actual law is going to save you a whole lot of headache and pain. So if you come up with a way to observe the law that causes you more headache and pain, that may not be what he had in mind. Look again. He looks around at all of them, and he says to the man, stretch out your hand. Now pause right there. Yes, Jesus has been known to work miracles. This is a man who's probably tried all kinds of stuff to deal with this withered hand. If his hand is still withered, and no normal person is going to go around and not try to do something about their hand that doesn't work. Okay, that person has probably already come to the conclusion that my hand just doesn't work. There were plenty of paralyzed people and injured people around. We didn't have reconstructive surgery. They didn't have antibiotics. They didn't have a lot of things. If you were incapacitated, that was what you dealt with. Now, try to escape the effects of having heard the story in Sunday school for a long, long time and try to get back into the minds of these fishermen who've been called to follow Jesus. Now, they have seen some miracles. They've seen the paralytic get up and go. They've seen the leper touched and healed. They've seen a couple of miracles. Well, so have you, and you still fret over things every once in a while. Give them some slack. What he just asked this man to do is something he's never been able to do before. Jesus did not reach out and say, poof, you're healed, and his hand just goes, bloop, bloop, and there it is. He gave him a command. What are you laughing at? He gave him a command. The guy's standing there with a hand, and he says, stretch out your hand. Okay. Now, there is some pause, there's some split second between receiving that command and actually doing it, in which he's got to consider, I've just been told something that I have experienced to be impossible for who knows how long. And everybody who's sitting there, in this moment between God giving this command, stretch out your hand, and it happening, there is this moment where we're trying to process this notion that Jesus has just told him to do something that has never been possible for him before. He knows it. The disciples that are there know it. The Pharisees know it. Let me bring you to this later part in the chapter. And there is his vindication. There's his statement before the Pharisees and their response, which was rage. They were not pleased that this man was healed. They were outraged because Jesus was not observing their understanding of how to observe the law. He wasn't doing it their way. It's too often the way we respond. And Jesus will come back to him dealing with Pharisees and the big deal he had with the Pharisees. We can sum it up in really two sentences. Jesus always deals with people who are, everybody is a, except for Jesus, is a sinner. All right? We can divide the population of people who fall short of the glory of God, who don't quite live up to the perfection of the holiness of God Himself. We can divide that entire population, which is all of us, into two parts. There are sinners who know they're sinners, and there are sinners who don't know that they are sinners. And when Jesus is dealing with the one group, and they know they've fallen short of the glory of God, and they know they need help, He is compassionate, and He is gracious, and He is loving, and he will come into their life. Now, he will tell them, don't do the same stupid stuff anymore. But I love you, and I redeem you, and I paid for it, and I've restored you, and you are whole, and you have a future. Don't sin anymore. The other group, which is the group, the Pharisees, and particularly the leaders of the Pharisees, the group they fall into are the ones that will not admit that they fall short. They have a hard time admitting that they fall short of God's standards because they are so invested in getting it all right that it is terribly troubling to them to say that they don't. Now, I'm not talking about lip service. Oh, I'm a sinner. Oh, I'm a sinner. I'll go make my little sacrifice and that's all I'm required to do. I'm talking about those who are insulted by the notion that they need a redeemer. Those who are so invested in getting it all right that they are annoyed when somebody else doesn't do the all getting it all right stuff the way they're supposed to. We'll come back to that group of people on another bit of the Gospels here. The Sermon on the Plain. What has this got to do? Luke has put it here for a purpose. And Luke has put this here with this notion, this bit about calling the disciples as a summary of the disciples that Jesus has been accumulating since he picked up the first four, and then Levi, and then the others. All right, so there's this paragraph looking back. They were all there to see this, and at least the four were there to see all these miracles. And we get to this event, which is a different day than the Sermon on the Mount you find in Matthew, but Luke's included this because this is something Jesus had to say after they had seen all these impossible things happen. And he says, there are four blessings here. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the hungry, blessed are those who weep, and blessed are those who are shunned, disdained, because of their identification with him. Now, here again, we've heard the Beatitudes enough that they don't slap us in the side of the head like they should. Blessed are the poor. And Luke, in Matthew's version, is blessed are the poor in spirit. But you want to know it, if you are brokenhearted and you haven't got the way to, you haven't got the means to make things work out, it almost doesn't really matter. Blessed are the poor. And do you think that was news to the poor? When you can't put food on the table, and he's using a very emphatic verb for poor. He's not just talking about those who aren't able to pay their bills. He's talking about those who are begging. Blessed are the impoverished. The Greek term is a really, really strong one. These are the ones who have no sustenance except to sit on the side of the street and hope that somebody does something to keep them alive. When's the last time you think they felt blessed? Blessed are the poor. The poor are sitting there thinking, what? You've got to be out of your mind. I couldn't tell, but if you say so, all right. Blessed are the hungry. Very much the same group of people on the surface of what he is saying. Blessed are those who are weeping. You're telling me, Lord, that I will be the object of your delight and favor and company when I'm broke, brokenhearted, can't find something to eat, and extremely unpopular. Is this making sense to you on the surface? Because it shouldn't be, okay? Please shake your heads no. I mean, because aside from what you know from the rest of the Gospels, he is saying something really, really, really startling here that doesn't sound possible. We think we need to make the bills to be blessed. We think we've got to have enough of what we need, not just to stay alive, but to be satisfied, to be blessed. We tend to equate blessing with material stuff. We tend to equate blessing with happiness, and that is pretty much what he says about those who weep, you will laugh. And the Greek word there just means you'll be happy. It's a future tense verb here. And blessed are you when men hate you because of me. How does that sound like good news? Sounds pretty hard. He follows that with a series of woes. Woe to you if you've already got enough to eat. Woe to you if you already are rich. Woe to you if everybody is just pleased as punch with you, because something's wrong if that's the case. How does this work? There are two blessings that are in the future tense, and there are two here that are in the present tense. What I mean is, blessed are the poor, because yours is the kingdom of God. If you know you do not have and will not have from this world what you need, then you know what you need to receive the Redeemer and the work of Jesus Christ to inherit the kingdom of God, and that blessing is yours right now. You are the kingdom of God. If you think you've got everything you need materially, and you're happy with that, you're probably not going to want a Redeemer. And if you don't want a Redeemer, you're not going to have one. Hungry and weeping. You will be fed, you will laugh. These are both in the future tense. If you look at this world and you look at what's in it, and you know in your heart there has got to be more than this. If you look at this world and you see what it is, and you grieve, you share the heart of Christ. If you can look at this world and be perfectly happy with it, you do not have God's heart. If you can have what this world has to offer and be satisfied, and that's enough for you, you are not longing for what Jesus Christ has to offer. And you will have something okay, but you will miss what is good and excellent. And you'll be okay for a day, but you will not outlive the problems that will come. The bottom line being the judgment of God. The last of these blessings is, blessed are you when men can't stand you and kick you out and do all sorts of manner of rotten things to you, which by this point they can see brewing because they've already irritated all their clergy. Blessed are you when, because of my name, not because of something stupid you do and blame on me, there is a difference, but because of your identification with me, people can't stand you, because that is a sign of life. If everybody around you who are not believers are perfectly happy because you pretend to not be a believer to make them comfortable, something's not right. If you find yourself knowing that balancing the checkbook is absolutely positively not the sustenance that you need, good stewardship it might be, but it's not going to give you a satisfying life. If you figured that out, and I'll tell you what, people with big checkbooks don't always figure that out. All right? People with checkbooks that, you know, are exciting, they know that even when you do manage to pay the bills, there's something that's not there in the checkbook, and that is never going to be there in the checkbook. You're likely to find it. If you realize there is something wrong with this world, you will understand why it needs a Redeemer. You will understand why you need a Redeemer, and you'll be more likely to receive the grace of Jesus Christ, and you'll be more likely to share it. If this is all you want, you're going to miss the rest. But if you know that what we've got here is not what we need, you're more likely to find it. And that is the curse of having what you want. When you have enough of what you want, you often stop looking for what you need, and you miss it. It can be jumping up and down in front of you with bells on, and you will miss it. When you know you haven't got what you need without Jesus Christ, you're more likely to recognize it's not just verbal assent. Yes, Lord, I want to serve you. It's something gripping and powerful and life-giving. And you let him in and you let him take control, and don't give him any rules, because he's the son of David and he is the Lord of the Sabbath. You let him show you how to live. You'll have something that the rich and the fed and those who are content do not have. Now, the Sabbath is a foreshadowing of what? It's a foreshadowing of eternal rest. The Sabbath is meant to be a blessing because it foreshadows that permanent blessing for the people of God. That freedom in Christ that will come now in the form of freedom from bondage and freedom from judgment, and eternally when it's freedom from all this nonsense that we do have to struggle with. The Sabbath is about restoration, not just of hands, but of hearts, lives, attitudes, experience. And it's about transformation right now. Restoration for eternity, transformation right now. It's not an unknown thing to look at how complicated our lives can be when we don't have health, when we can't make ends meet, when we're angsting about relationships, when we don't feel blessed. And Jesus simply says, you are blessed. It's easy to think, that doesn't sound terribly possible. I mean, I can intellectually believe that if God says it's possible, and I argue with it, but I can believe a lot of things that I don't feel and seem to experience at the moment. It can sound impossible when you really are at the bottom and things are painful and they're frightening. It's very easy to believe, just like the man with the withered hand, I've just been told to do something that I have never done and can't do. You see why Luke has put these blessings following this miracle? You can do it because he said to do it. He says to receive his blessing. Not just happiness that's in, that you would think of in Greek or in English, but Baruch Ha. Jesus is a Hebrew speaker speaking to Hebrew people. They understand that blessing is something deeper, more powerful, much richer. And it's about shalom. It's about the wholeness and fullness of life being as big and as wonderful as it was created to be. And God can say, in the midst of your poverty, in the midst of your, whatever your situations are that make your week complicated, in the middle of it, he can say, you are blessed. Be blessed. And really, there's an act of obedience that does follow. To do something that feels impossible and to know that you're blessed, he makes possible. There's no doubt he healed the guy with the withered hand, did he not? Told the guy to do what he thought was possible, but made it possible. And he is telling you to understand how enormous his blessings are on you when nothing else seems to satisfy. This is satisfaction. And there are moments when that does not sound possible or as big as it really is. And you need to understand how big his blessings are, especially compared to all the little things that get us bent out of shape. And it might not feel possible, but guess what? If he tells you to know how blessed you are, he has made it possible. And he has done it for you. Now, he has also told you, fishers of men, that you need to be taking, that if you're going to be disciples, and you'll notice that in Luke, when he calls the disciples, he also designated the 12 as apostles. The disciples are his followers. The apostles are those he is sending. If you're going to be a disciple, you're going to be trained to be fishers of men. It is for you not only to understand this blessing, but to carry it forward and make sure other people know about it. It is... There are... those of you who like to fish and are familiar with the wider fishing community know how adept they are at knowing all of the exceptions to what can and cannot be posted. Ponds and streams and so forth, and know that, you know, the stream bed of a perennial stream can't be, that's not private property. You can wade up a stream an awful long way where the land is posted on either side. Didn't you know that? What's wrong with you people?
Can't do that in Colorado.
Can't do it in Colorado. Well, what's wrong with them? Okay. There are certain, you know, there are certain benchmark, high water, low water, and those who fish all the time, they know these laws. But I want you to know, when it comes to fishing for men, there is no such thing as a time or a place where fishing is prohibited. Not fishing for men is prohibited if you are his disciple. And Jesus is showing these people the importance of the blessing and the importance of knowing what is possible. Because they have got to do this, and they have got to know how strong the Spirit of God is, and they have got to follow through. They are the ones, and he's telling them now, he's already called them apostles, they're going out. Now, he hasn't sent them out yet on their first field trip. But if you're a disciple, do not think you're just going to tread water as a disciple to the end of your days. The purpose of being a disciple is to become one who will take that message to the lepers, to the paralytics, to the guys with withered hands, with withered hearts, who have no hope, who don't know where their satisfaction is going to come from. I'm going to end this with a sound clip. Are we? There's a sound clip. And I think you will understand why I picked the sound clip for you, fishers of men, disciples. God is good. He's a God of grace. There's nothing written in the Bible that doesn't say don't make obnoxious loud electronic noises in church, as long as it's not disruptive. We can debate that, but we're not going to. This is from one of my favorite Mississippi theologians by the name of Jerry Clower, who, if you're over 40, you might remember.
I went to see Marcel Edmond the other day. His brother Claude was the only one in the community catching any fish. Folks was going and they wasn't catching nothing. Old Claude Ledbetter, he'd come in with a pickup truck loaded down. So the State Game and Fish Commission of Mississippi decided they'd go fishing with Claude, just see how he was catching them. Claude had told them, popped off, said, y'all don't know how to do it. Said, y'all ought to just go with me and watch me. Well, the game warden got up in the boat with him and they took off out in the middle of the river. The game warden said, all right, Claude, I'm going to see how you catching all these fish when can't nobody else catch none. Claude raised the lid on the boat seat and got a big, long stick of dynamite. Lit the fuse on it. Let it go down to kind of short and draw it back and chunk it. And them big catfish come turning their belly up. Whooping it out of that water, and Claude was just getting them by the tub full. Game warden said, boy, that's against the law. You can't do that. Don't you know you're breaking the law? A Claude's done lit another big stick of dynamite. Handed it to the game warden. He's going, shh. Game warden took that stick of dynamite, said, you idiot, this is against the law. You can't do this. Claude said, you're going to sit there and argue or fish.